And the court calls Kozik versus Hale, case number 09CA2556. Also, do any of you have any questions about timing procedures or any other procedures here today? Okay. Each side will have 15 minutes. Appellant can reserve whatever time you would like. If you want me to try to help you, let me know, and I'll try to remember to do that and remind you.
I'll take any help I can get you. Okay. So perhaps 5 minutes.
5 minutes. I'll try to pay attention and remind you.
I will as well. If it may please the court, my name is Doug Meyer, registration number 19883. With me today is my co-counsel, Ann Whalen Gill, 14610, and we represent Paul Kozik, who is with us today here in the front row. I filed suit on behalf of Paul Kozik approximately 5.5 years ago. So as I reflected about this oral argument today, I thought, what can I say in 15 minutes that hasn't already been said? We filed an opening brief that was 50 pages long, a reply brief almost 30. And so therefore we stand on our briefs as submitted. However, as I reflected on this case, there was something that was gnawing at me. Something that we do mention in our briefs, footnote 2 on page 39 as well as page 19, so it is in our briefs. However, we don't emphasize it, and in fact, we in some ways gloss over it. However, as I contemplated, why is this case bothering me so much, it came to that. And here's what it is. In the record, pages 965 to 967, it was an exhibit at trial. It's a letter from the defendant, Alan Hale, to me. Now, this was an exhibit at trial. Again, it's at pages 965 to 967. And what's important about this letter is that this was a year after Alan Hale's representation ended. So he was no longer acting as an advocate. He was no longer representing Mr. Kozik. It was more than a year later. However, it was also before we filed suit in this case. This letter is dated April 1st, 2005. Suit was filed several months after that. And as set forth in the letter, Mr. Hale, I had asked Mr. Hale, you know, what happened? What happened in this condemnation case? Why was there no expert testimony? Why was there no current valuation? Why did you use a valuation that was 3.5 years old? And after he discusses the timeliness of the appraisal, he comes back and says, and this is a direct quote from the defendant, on page 2 of his letter, Mr. Dyson's supplemental report more accurately reflected the highest and best use of the properties to which the parties ultimately stipulated at trial. It was not an otherwise inadmissible valuation. Now, why is this troublesome? I think it's troublesome because this isn't, first of all, in the context of a legal malpractice case. And we have a situation here where now this same defendant goes into trial and comes before this court, and he says exactly the opposite, 180 degrees the opposite. He now comes and says, you know what? It was not admissible. It shows the disingenuousness of the argument. It's relevant to that. And I think it's also relevant on perhaps another issue, and that is that there may be nobody in this courtroom, present panel excluded, of course, who may have more experience in eminent domain cases than Alan Hale. He is the expert, a preeminent lawyer. He knows these cases inside and out. And he tells us it was not an otherwise admissible valuation.
There's plenty of other evidence before Judge McGahee that it, other opinions, I guess, that it was otherwise not admissible. Certainly the testimony of Mr. Weston, the testimony of Mr. Fisher, I believe. So there certainly was other evidence. So Judge McGahee had all this before him, did he not? You put the letter in evidence, I assume.
Not at the trial, yes, but not. I don't recall it being an exhibit at the hearing. I can't recall.
So then it's not part of the record before us.
Well, it is, Your Honor, because it's part of the entire trial record in the case.
But the motion before us, in the order before us, is Judge McGahee's order. Actually, the summary judgment order, but it, based on the Rule 56H order, that it was not the admissible. Now you're telling me at that hearing before McGahee, you didn't put in this letter that you now say is so important.
I can't recall if it was argued or not, but it is part of the record, Your Honor. I mean, this was a this case was remanded for a new trial. So you can't just ignore what happened at the what happened prior to that. It's all part of the same record. And I would be surprised if I didn't argue it. But as I stand here before the court today, I can't say whether I did or not. But it is still part of the record, and the court can still consider it. I don't believe that whether it was an exhibit at this hearing or not affects that issue, because the entire record, the trial transcripts, I mean, both parties cite at length from the trial transcripts in this case in their briefs. Okay, thank you. And I also take issue, I do take issue with one statement, that is there was not testimony from Mr. Fisher nor Mr. Weston that it was not admissible. Because, of course, that's why this case was reversed in the first place, is that expert testimony on the admissibility of the supplemental appraisal was considered to be improper. Instead, they discussed things like project influence rule, comparable sales,
that's what I meant.
I'm sorry.
There were affidavits from Weston and Fisher before Judge McGahee.
And from the court concluded.
Right. Counsel, as long as we're talking about what's part of this case and what's not, I'd like to clarify some things. In the complaint you file in this case, you allege three different acts of malpractice, as I read it. One, the untimely filing of the appraisal. Two, the failure to list Mr. Nelson as an expert witness. And three, the giving of bad advice with respect to the tort claim. I'm just paraphrasing your complaint. Counsel, when I read the jury instructions in the first trial, I see no mention in there of anything relating to giving bad advice with respect to the tort claim. Was that tried to the jury in the first case?
I think it was, Your Honor.
The jury returned a general verdict, so didn't they decide that claim?
Well, that certainly is the defendant's argument, isn't it?
Why isn't it over then? Same question with respect to Mr. Nelson, by the way. And there I find no jury instruction at all about Mr. Nelson not being listed as being negligence. And I don't know if the jury, it was argued or not. It wasn't argued, actually. I read your closing argument. You didn't argue it.
I did not recall it was argued, and we did not call Mr. Nelson.
So haven't you had your bite at the apple and it's over with respect to those claims?
No.
Why not?
Because you have to put this in the context of the case at the time of the trial. And going into the trial, Judge Lemon, in her summary judgment motion, had said, I've looked at this, and it is admissible. I believe it's admissible. That's what she says. It's quoted in our brief at least once, maybe twice. And so going into this first trial, we were under the understanding that Judge Lemon would follow her previous order, where she says, I've reviewed the supplementary appraisal. It is a admissible appraisal. And that was where we went into the trial. It was only on the first morning of trial that Judge Lemon sort of flip-flopped on us and said, well, I'm not going to make a decision on that. I'm going to let it go to the jury on whether or not the supplemental appraisal is admissible.
What does that have to do with Mr. Nelson being called, argued that there was negligence with respect to calling Nelson as a witness or with respect to giving negligent advice with respect to the tort claim? Do you understand my question?
I do.
It seems like those claims were tried or they were abandoned at trial, or if they were tried, the jury verdict came out against your client, and they're finished. They're over with. And it seems like in your brief you're trying to revive those claims. And I think you are you not?
We are trying to revive them. But I disagree that based on the way the case was framed at that point, we had the right to rely on the court's opinion, and therefore, don't get us wrong. Right? We acknowledge that the best evidence of the valuation is the Dyson supplemental appraisal. It certainly is the best evidence, but not the only evidence. And so based upon the court's ruling, we proceeded to trial based upon the assumption that the supplemental appraisal would have been admissible. We didn't emphasize or argue the part about Mr. Nelson, or even overly, because going into it, we didn't think we needed to. And it's sort of, I think we have the right to rely upon the court's previous orders in the case in terms of approaching trial.
But after those orders, said there's no negligence by the defendants. Whatever you put in at the time was the evidence of negligence. I don't understand why you would argue that those claims are still liable. You didn't seem to argue that. I'm not talking about the $2,000 appraisal. I understand.
Right.
But these other two claims are in your complaint. You seem to say are still part of this case on remand, and I don't think that they were. And I think Judge McGee also found they were not, and you seem to be arguing that point.
I know, and I understand what the court's saying, but to take a trial and to segment it out like that, I don't think works in real life. The jury, they weren't asked, okay, did you find for based on the Nelson issue? Did you find the trial was so infected with the reversible error that the mandate was to have a new trial. The mandate was not to, okay, just have a new trial on this issue, a new trial on this issue. It is speculation for us to know how much the infection of the reversible error affected the jury.
Judge Meyer, you have less than 4 minutes. Left.
Was there anything in your appeal that even called to the attention of the First Division of this court that there had been claims about giving negligent advice about a tort claim or failing to call Mr. Nelson? Was that briefed at all in front of the First Division?
In the first appeal?
Yeah.
I'd have to go back and look at the briefs, but I can't imagine that it wasn't addressed.
Okay. But if it wasn't addressed, would you agree that it was abandoned then?
Well, that simply because we didn't choose to appeal on that issue, I don't think means that it's abandoned. We appealed on what we thought was the most clear issue of error, and that was allowing expert testimony on the issue of admissibility.
Maybe I better let you talk about the main issue, which you haven't got to yet, which is Judge McGee's ruling on the project that the 2004 appraisal is not admissible.
I'm sorry?
Your main issue on appeal here is that that Judge McGee erred in finding the 2004 appraisal.
Correct.
Would not have otherwise been admissible.
Right.
I better let you address that.
Well, there's no question the party stipulated to the highest and best use. The only thing that the project influence went to, the only issue to which it was relevant, was the highest and best use. Once that is stipulated to by the parties in the underlying case, the project influence is no longer an issue at that point. It had nothing to do with the comparable sales, nothing to do with the methodology, the highest and best use, the project influence, as argued by Arvada and as argued by the defendants even in this case, only had to go to the issue of the highest and best use. They didn't disagree on the highest and best use. So that's the first issue. The second problem, of course, is the methodology. Judge McGahee talks about units. The methodology here was saleable square feet. So Judge McGahee doesn't even discuss the methodology that was used, and he errs as a matter of law on saying that somehow our case, our situation, is the same as Schulhoff and Vail Associates, which have been subsequently limited to only raw land cases. They're totally different. And then the third issue, the comparable sales. The defendants don't address this in their answer brief, but in the underlying case, Arvada only objected to the first two sales. I never objected to the second three sales. So as a matter of law, Judge McGehee is wrong, is in error, to conclude that the final three sales are also inadmissible. While you can argue different evidence in support of the case within the case, you can't change the facts of the case within the case. And the facts here were Arvada only objected to the first two. So those are the only two that are on the table. Thank you. I'll save 40 seconds.
Okay.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Palmieri, registration number 14252. Appearing with me is my co-counsel, Heather Kelly, registration number 36052. We're proud to represent Alan Hale and Amanda Atkinson Bradley, who are also present in the courtroom. You heard from Mr. Meyer his closing argument that he gave on December 15th of 2006 in the legal malpractice case. And as Judge Richman had noted, in fact, the jury returned a general verdict following that closing argument. We're not here to relitigate that matter. To address the court's question about the underlying appeal, the table of contents from the opening brief and the underlying appeal raised three arguments. First, that the trial court erred in refusing to rule on the admissibility of the Dyson appraisal. That was squarely addressed by the Court of Appeals in the 2008 order. Second, that the trial court erred in not following the case within the case methodology. Again, that was squarely addressed by the Court of Appeals in 2008. And then the third argument is just simply a summary of argument. What we have here is a situation that has involved a jury trial in 2004.
Stop you real quick there before you move on. It seems to me that the scope of the remand is sort of what's at issue here. Particularly when your counterpart said at the end that the mandate was to have a new trial. Can you respond to that for me?
The mandate and what the trial or what the Court of Appeals said was the trial court here should have determined as a matter of law whether the supplemental appraisal would have been admissible at the condemnation trial if it had been timely disclosed. That was the remand. The remand then said we're going to remand for new trial if necessary. Judge McGee squarely addressed that.
Really wasn't what the court said, was it?
Well,
I don't recall in Kozik. I'll refer to it as Kozik 1, actually saying that it made the conclusion in the order that the trial court should have addressed whether or not the 2004 appraisal was admissible, but it didn't say we're remanding for that purpose.
Well, what it says, I'm reading at page 9, Judge Hawthorne, what it says is the trial court did not make that determination, but rather allowed the jury to do so. We conclude that in leaving the issue of admissibility up to the jury, the trial court erred.
Right.
So it was remanded. Judge McGehee squarely addressed that. We have an evidentiary hearing, one-day evidentiary hearing. We had a stipulated procedure where the parties agreed to submit cross motions for determination of question of law. We have the affidavits. We have the subsequent testimony. His determination on that is supported under an abuse of discretion standard. There's evidence in the record to support it. There's no argument regarding an error in law on that.
So were there stipulations on what the scope of the retrial would look like above and beyond the 2004 appraisal issue?
The scope was to address the issue on remand, which had to do with the admissibility of the 2004. That was addressed in a February of 2009 status conference.
That was it. That was the only issue on remand that the party stipulated was going to be for the court to decide on remand as a matter of law.
And as a first step, that's true. So then what happened was you have that order. You have the evidentiary hearing in July. You have a ruling from the bench. It wasn't reduced then until reduced to writing until September 10th, and then pro tunc back to July 23rd. At that point then, to address your concern, Judge Hawthorne, you have to go back and look at what we had. And what we had there then was a motion for summary judgment. And the motion for summary judgment addressed all of the issues that had been pled in the underlying case, all of these issues were addressed. The tort claim, for example, was specifically pled in the complaint, and there was testimony in the underlying trial addressing that. Two witnesses in particular, Richard Daly, Andrew Kroll, those were lawyers who were dealing directly with the tort claim. The standard of care testimony from Goddard addressed that as well, and there was a general verdict that was returned on that. In addition, then, going beyond that, not just from the standard of care perspective, the negligence, on the causation issue, we then circled back to address the causation again to say, okay, we now know the 2004 appraisal was inadmissible. That's what Judge McGahee ruled. There's evidence in the record based upon his assessment of the credibility to support that. There's no other admissible valuation testimony that plaintiff has then presented. There are two arguments that they attempted to make in the summary judgment. First had to do with the real estate broker, Nelson. That issue had been addressed in the underlying case, and in fact, the record will indicate that contrary to Mr. Meyer's argument, that motion and those issues were addressed pre-trial in a motion in limine on Project Influence that he himself filed on October 31st of 2006. So what we had when we had Judge Lemon's order denying the motion for summary judgment, it created an issue then, and both sides filed motions in limine to address that. Judge Lemon, as under the Jones versus Feiger, Collison, Kilmer case, addressed at the beginning of trial that a denial for a motion for summary judgment is simply that, a denial. It's not a ruling. There was no affirmative argument there upon which the plaintiff would rely to avoid presenting any evidence at that time. In fact, to the contrary, it was just denying the defendant's motion for summary judgment. So all of those issues, the tort case, Nelson as a testifying expert or lay witness, all of those were presented during the underlying case leading up to the 2006 jury trial in which the jury, by stipulation, was asked to return a general verdict. And a general verdict does just that. The jury decides who wins and loses, and they return a verdict for the defendants. So if there's any evidence in the record on negligence, on causation, or even the lack of damages, all of that would be subsumed in the general verdict, and in fact, that verdict was returned. What Judge McGahee did was to recognize that and to apply the law of the case to sort through and say what exactly was addressed and what hasn't been addressed.
The law of the case was a res judicata. It sounds like it was a res judicata.
It could be res judicata, and in fact, we had raised it as collateral estoppel on res judicata in a motion for summary judgment. Judge McGahee said, well, in terms of the issues there, I'm going to deny it at least as a motion for summary judgment on collateral estoppel because that was the argument we had raised. And then we just came back and we filed a broader motion for summary judgment. But whether it's law of the case, res judicata, or collateral estoppel, the fact is the plaintiff has had his day in court and presented all of this evidence and all of the arguments first in 2004 in the condemnation case. We now know Judge McGahee's ruling that the jury in the condemnation case heard the admissible evaluation testimony. They heard what they were supposed to hear, and they returned a verdict finding just compensation for Mr. Kozik. But beyond that, in the 2006 legal malpractice case, let's take a look at really what plaintiff is attempting to argue. It's the same evidence. It's the same arguments. It's going to be that somehow the law firm or the lawyers were negligent. Their expert is Goddard. Goddard had every opportunity to present that in any arguments that he had about negligence. We had competing expert testimony in the form of Tim Flanagan, and the jury heard that. On causation, again, the jury in the malpractice case heard all the same issues and arguments, and the same with damages, because again, we now know that he's received just compensation in the underlying 2004 case, and therefore he has no damages here. But beyond that, and to address a point or comment that you'd made, Judge Richman, early on, was even if we'd have a remand and a new trial, we're going to hear the same things. Because under Colorado law, the doctrine of judgmental immunity or strategy decisions by lawyers are a defense. And that was squarely addressed and that was squarely litigated in the underlying malpractice case. So the lawyers took the stand and explained to the jury the catch-22 that they were in. They're dealing with the Dyson appraisal. It's a big number. Yes, you want to get it in, but yet on the other hand, there are problems with it. And how are we going to address that? In terms of the timeliness, that's what they addressed. In terms of Nelson, they brought it up. And in fact, Nelson had a number of issues that they had to address. He's a real estate broker. He's not an appraiser. Is he going to be qualified to testify? What are we going to? Are you really going to base your whole case on that? He was coming in with an offer. We cite the Colorado cases that say an offer does not present evidence sufficient to.
This was all tried to the jury to malpractice, and they found a general verdict for the large.
And they returned the general verdict.
So let me try to direct your attention to another subject, which is, we haven't really got to, which is Judge McGahee's determination that this 2004 appraisal is tainted by the project influence rule, by improper use of comparable sales, and by this business about saleable square feet.
Yes.
But I really want to, since you have very limited time left, would you help us understand why the 2004 appraisal, what parts of it are tainted, if you will, by project influence?
Project influence taints, and in fact, as Judge McGahee found, is pervasive throughout the appraisal. And it doesn't just turn on the stipulation regarding the highest and best use of the property. And let me explain. The highest and best use arguably would have been for retail. That was the existing use at the time. The stipulation would be to change the highest and best use to a mixed use so that you could have some residential and some commercial. That doesn't end the analysis, though. What you have to do is you have to look then at the project, which is the Arvada Urban Renewal. And has that project enhanced the value of this property?
How long had that project been going on by this time? Years, right?
Years, yes.
So how are you supposed to do that? You're supposed to back out the property as if the urban renewal had never existed and come up with the value of the property absent the urban renewal?
Not that it never existed, but you can't have the project enhancement. And let me give you two examples.
So anytime you look at the buildings around, the buildings that had been built as part of the urban renewal project, are part of the project influence.
Exactly.
And that's essentially what Judge McGahee was saying.
Exactly.
But didn't that start in 1981?
Yeah.
Well,
it was some
time ago.
And so this building, Mr. Kozak's property, has been sitting there for 20-something years being affected by the urban renewal, but you can't take that into account.
That's what the law says. And in fact, then two examples. One had the water tower project, and I don't know how familiar you are with this area. It's just in old Arvada. It's just on the other side of some railroad tracks. Even with the highest and best use, if water tower raises the value, that's project influence, and that has to be backed out. There are other examples. The as-is nature of it, the water tower, the neighborhood discussion. All of those, contrary to plaintiff's argument, were addressed by the expert appraisers Fisher and Weston. We gathered the record sites at page 17 of our answer brief. So contrary to plaintiff's argument that all this goes away with the stipulation of the highest and best use was not the case.
It's de novo? It's abuse of discretion.
Abuse of discretion. What we had here was a mixed question of law and fact, and the only case cited by the plaintiff for the de novo review, the E-470 case, in fact, when you read it, the court discusses the various approaches but applied an abuse of discretion standard there. So in fact, for factual determinations here and a mixed question of law and fact, it's an abuse of discretion standard. He heard the testimony. He evaluated the credibility of the witnesses. He's in the better position then to evaluate those factual decisions.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Palmieri. If we conclude that Judge McGahee properly found that the 2004 appraisal was otherwise inadmissible, other than because of the time limit, do we have to address the other two bases for his finding that it was inadmissible?
If you find it that it's project influence, I think that ends the determination. He did a thorough review, did a thorough order, made additional findings there, but if you affirm on project influence,
as long as he was correct on one of his bases,
it's inadmissible.
It's inadmissible.
Yes. So then to summarize, what we have here is a situation in which there was a jury trial in 2004. Another jury trial in 2006, the appeal in 2008, an evidentiary hearing in 2009. And not is it just a second bite at the apple, the plaintiff is now seeking a fifth bite at the apple. There's sufficient evidence in the record to support Judge McGahee's finding on the 2004 appraisal. Similarly, the record supports his finding granting the motion for summary judgment.
Ask one other question. They suggest that there was other types of negligence that had occurred here, like you should have gotten a new appraisal, you knew this was no good, etc. The things that they say Goddard would say at a new trial, were those part of the case below in the first malpractice?
He certainly had every opportunity to address it because Goddard testified, and they're just small spins on the same theme, which has to do with the admissibility of a 2004 appraisal. So it certainly was well within the presentation that the jury heard in 2006, whether they had those specific words and those specific arguments, not to the same detail that they have.
Is there any effort to amend the complaint in this case post remand?
None. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Meyer, looks like you have about 41 seconds left.
Thank you. This idea that the supplemental appraisal is that project influence is pervasive is pure fiction. They cannot point to any place in the supplemental appraisal that discusses the project other than the neighborhood section of the appraisal. To say that it's pervasive anywhere else is simply fiction. Even Fisher.
To admit that the neighborhood section does discuss all the stuff that's going on in the urban renewal area, right?
Of course.
And so are you saying that it had nothing to do with the value of the that Dyson came up with?
Absolutely. Because Mr. Fisher's appraisal has the same information in his neighborhood section. They both testified that that's common to put a description in the neighborhood section, but that doesn't mean that the comps or the methodology or anything else is based upon project influence. It is not pervasive. It's only in that one place. Just like if it's pervasive in ours, then it's pervasive in Mr. Fisher's.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. This matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.